says, I brought a book today.
Leave me alone.
This just needs a scapegoat, Amy. I need a scapegoat. Cover up.
Rivka, do you want to say hi, Barry?
The topic of today is marriage.
Hi, Barry.
I went to the wedding, the easy part, the marriage part. The wedding is only on 1, 2, 3.
What? I'm digging in. Cover up.
9 to 10 minutes, 3.
Rivka, do you want to say hi, Barry?
The topic of today is marriage.
Hi, Barry.
Right, say that. After the wedding, marriage will come, we'll talk about later. I went to the wedding is the easy part, the marriage is hard. The wedding is only on 1, 2, 3.
I'm digging in. I don't know. Keep it up. There is what you're doing with me,
people are walking into the room right now. Abuelo's looking in the Shulchan Aruch. I'm not wasting his time. I'm going to stop the tape. He's not here anytime. I should put on the AVR for you.
Okay.
But here he goes.
I will use this book only because it's a very convenient one. It's good to have. I told my cousin Tal they should get it. Since it's not a very... It's good for anybody. But on the other hand, if anyone knows Rabbi Kaplan's work, he's a tremendous man. And whatever he writes, it's worth reading. The title, Made in Heaven, is a... paraphrase of an expression that we say that the Gemara tells us that before a child is created, child is conceived, there's already a bas kol that comes out and says who the shidduch will be. Now, of course, this does not take away free will, but still, there exists this principle of kasher, what we call. Now, the it's interesting, there's a shot of the Me'iri, which I think is worth discussing. The Me'iri is the beginning of Sota. The other Gemara said that seems to say that it was what's called Ziva Grisha, which is simply treated as the first marriage, then, you know, it's sort of happens. Ziva Grishon, the first, simply means the first marriage, okay? Then we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Basher, 48 before the child is born, and it's sort of, it's something which is, you might still call it a Minas Shamayim, in heaven is decreed. Nothing to do with the person's merit, the first born yet. Where Zivit Shani, a second marriage, according to the simple pshat, is the fi ma'asa, is according to the person's deeds. Now, since most of us intend on getting married only once, in good health, so what does that mean? I mean, it's just pot luck for us? So the Me'iri is an interesting pshat. The Me'iri says the Zivit Rishon means that the child is married off young, before the child develops, like it was done in the old years. They married them off with kids. The kids were born and they're okay, they said, okay, you'll marry her and you'll marry him and boom, 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 boom. Then it's almost like kind of a potluck thing as well. It's also a sheriff. But zivik shenim is the person waits till he or she is older to marry. Then it's be massive. But that's the case, all of us are zivik shenim. In the sense of the Meiri's interpretation. So the person marries when he's already mature. Unfortunately, some people marry when they're not mature, and the results are catastrophic. You can be not mature at 18, 20, 22, I won't go beyond that. But the people will never reach maturity their whole life. But this is something very, very serious. Rabbi Kaplan speaks in his second chapter about love. And as the Rambam writes, love of between man and woman is a very deep emotion. If nothing else, that is the muscle which is used to express deep love between Hashem and the Jewish people, Shir HaShirim. What's critical is that the love between husband and wife, she was called an Ava She'ena Tzluya B'dav. What does that mean? If a man marries in order to get to receive, then it's a dangerous situation. Because you never know when the balance sheet will change. Right now he's receiving more than he's giving. He's happy with his marriage. 5 years from now he has to turn around. He'll be unhappy, or she'll be unhappy, as the case may be. And therefore the only time, that a marriage can really be lasting is when the partners for the marriage are interested more in giving than in receiving. And as psychologists and colleagues mostly have both noted, love for a person is strengthened and created by giving to that person. Not the other way around, as is often thought. I give to that person because I love that person. It's the other way around, in reality. I love the person because I give to the person. And there are many proofs to this, psychological proofs. So, you know, individuals will take away from their families, and the whole story. When the mother couldn't give to her child, she didn't love that child so much. Paradoxically, oh, I've got a free ride. That's if you give the child anything. No, it's the other way around. Develops gradually. Not like in Hollywood, where all of a sudden this man sees this woman or vice versa and he's just knocked over. It happens like that sometimes, okay, but it doesn't always happen that way. And if it happens that way, be careful. He's not being blinded by love. Love is not supposed to be blind. Love is supposed to be based upon rational thought. Quote the famous comment of Shamshon of Paul Hirsch, Yitzchak married Rivka, became his wife. And after that, Vayelva, he loved her. Rav Hirsch explains that he loved her after the marriage. Not like somebody said he loved her before the marriage. He loved her after the marriage. As I was in Europe in the old days of Shidduch, you know, 1, 2, 3, the parents thought this is appropriate. They married them off. And they got, most times they got to love each other. They got to hate each other. Most of them got to love each other. I'm not recommending that you go back to the European system. You know, see the what once most, or that you're not even. Don't misinterpret my words. Same time, I don't like these lengthy relationships. That those be interminable. Some years back, when Moshe Vick, according to the Bracha, wrote an article in the Yiddish newspaper. He was a Masada Gittin, he said, so many Gittin among the American families, he said, he made a new psak. He thinks you're not allowed to get engaged until you go out 7 times. They wanted to string him up in Garofar. Los Sudos, great, 7 times. I know someone in Bnei Brak who went out to 4 times, and he's still having an oing. So they wanted about a 5th time, so he went to Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, I guess it all depends where you come from. So I think that I don't know about the dates are so critical, except it's low where we come from. But I've told my Talmidim that I think if they're going out with a young lady, and things should be going up, should be just sort of drag along, you know, schlep along, you know. I think if they're going out, there should be a relationship got stronger and stronger, and have strong, look at how strong it gets, stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. What they call it is hot and heavy, or whatever they want to call it, but it has to get, it has to reach a point. So I told my Talmidim that in my opinion, speaking from personal experience, I think it's that the approximate right amount of time they should be going out. The normal condition should be some total of 3 months. That's all. For so long, that's yes. I know. So in 2 weeks they get engaged. You know, everyone knows that. And so the Shiva circles. Other circles takes them a year. So I'm just giving you my opinion. For whatever it's worth. 3 months. And once I'm on the 3 month topic, how long should they be engaged? 3 months. How long it takes to make a preparation. But not these 1 year engagements, a year and a half, or even 10 months. What are you all this for? It's not healthy. Not healthy. We haven't yet spoken about the physical attraction between the man and woman. I'll put that off maybe for next week. That's a very hard topic to talk about. But certainly for that reason alone, it's not healthy. Because these long engagements and long courtships are just not. Okay. Chapter 3 talks about prohibited marriages. We've spoken about it in the last time. The next chapter talks about engagement. Called Shidduchim. Talks about the Shachar. Before, I'm reading it from Rabbi Kaplan, he's the boss. Before formally announcing their engagement as customer, a couple to meet with both sets of parents. Where practical. It is also customary for both the parents to meet each other. I don't know about that. Is that really customary? Yeah, really? Yeah. I didn't do it. Well, actually, my parents and the in-laws knew each other somehow 30 years before, you know, but they never met officially in that context. Okay. It is important for the couple to have the blessings of both sets of parents. I agree. Nevertheless, the parents did not agree to a marriage, the couple is not obliged to obey them. This is a quote from the Rambam, but it's not so simple. It's not so simple. The way I understand it, they don't have to obey them if the parents' objection is unreasonable. They don't like this girl or this boy, and they don't really give a reason for it. But if they have a very strong reason, then I think I have to go to a rabbi. The rabbi will decide whether the parents are right or not. That's my opinion on this matter. Nowadays, times in general custom, a man usually gives his bride a diamond engagement ring. It's certainly done, but I'm not so sure this is a backup to chasm. I have a case now, it's just tickled the entire of the couple got divorced, unfortunately, but now they worry about what to do with the engagement ring. It was $4,000.
That's not a lot of money.
No, not a lot of money. And you know, I'll tell you the soup, the truth. To me, it seems to be absurd. A woman waiting for the engagement ring, all she's worried about her whole life is she shouldn't get stolen, she shouldn't get mugged, and she shouldn't get turned over, and no one should see it. Well, it's crazy. Of course, such sorrow as an engagement ring. I'm serious. I don't understand. I don't find any mucker anywhere how long for an engagement ring. Piece of jewelry was yes. That he quotes here from the Rashbam. They used to give jewelry. That's true. Has to be a $4,000 diamond ring. I'll tell you nicer. I was once. This goes back when I was before I was married. I used to be in the dorm in the yeshiva. I used to eat breakfast. Those days I had time to wash for breakfast. I used to wash. One day I come to the little sink in the yeshiva to wash for breakfast. And right in front of me, on a little ledge, I've never been there, a little ledge there with a little mirror thing, a diamond ring. Right in front of me. Only one ring. A diamond ring. The first thing I did was put it in my pocket. I was afraid I wanted some of the help. I just walk away with it. Then, took out my washing up. I first things first. I look around. Who was the likely candidate? So I saw. Yeah, I figured a married couple wouldn't be because probably a second ring. So I mean, it was probably an engaged couple. Also, more likely she'd forget it. She's not used to it. There was a couple of breakfasts. One too many women in the cafeteria. But it was. They look married, they look like an engaged couple to me. So I walk over to the halach, I have a siman, I don't know if they're not cheating. So I made the following cheshbon in my mind. I walk over to the couple and I said, excuse me, did either of you lose anything? To give my wife a hint at all what I was talking about, that they couldn't. The woman looks at her hand and gives out a shriek. Pull out the ring, David. This could not have been a fake out. Absolute horror. He had the husband sitting right there. And he was the ring. Now the biggest miss of a Shabbat Aveda I ever did in my life. So for that reason, they can have a diamond ring. So I can have a Shabbat Aveda. Okay. But other than that, all it is, I got some people got mugged in the elevator. They went to their diamond ring. I said, it can kill you with a diamond ring. And then I wasn't listening to me, but I'm telling you. I tell it to the boys and to the world, but I'm trying to be fair. I don't like the whole thing. I don't see where it comes from. You want to buy a piece of jewelry. If you buy a piece of jewelry, that's worn on special occasions. You have to walk around the whole your whole life with it and worry about it. And you wear buy something which is worn on a chasana, something like a yontif, a Shabbos. You make something special. That's my opinion, but I know that's unpopular. And here's the famous pasuk in our chapter. Even when a diamond ring is bought, the groom should not go beyond his means to purchase it. Is there any groom that you know has the means to buy a diamond ring? I don't know. So he goes to his father. Oh, so right now the father says, once they're involved, I gave her the diamond ring, I can tell her what to do. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. At the beginning of a marriage, many things are needed. Forgo them for the sake of a ring is ludicrous. You have times of lack of money or even debt resulting from the person who is engaged in quite a serious reason of the marriage. It's crazy. I agree. I think it's crazy. The custom of giving is so ingrained that many couples feel that they are not engaged without one. This, of course, is nonsense. In many of the best marriages, the bride was never given a diamond engagement ring.
Feel complimented. All right.
Customary of a formal party, noyin, conditions. I never had a vote. We never had a tonight. We never had an engagement party. We never had anything. We're still married. I guess it all depends upon the time of the year. We got engaged after college was out. Yeah, so that's all the. My wife's friends were no longer. You know, they scattered around. She was a student in this very institution. And as soon as they finished their finals, everyone ran. I was kind of sorry. It was together there. Although my friends were around, but it wasn't so in those days. You didn't have the, you know, they have now in the morgue lounge. They didn't have that stuff in those years. They hardly had the morgue in those years because it was barely being, no, it was around. Not that old. It was there, but they didn't have this institution. Yeah. Not so bad. I think it's not usually not overdone. A very nice little get togethers. It shouldn't be a heel to invite the whole world to spend $10,000 just on the tonight. I've seen it. The caterer, the shul and flatbush, and ices, and water cakes. My circle, when they spent, I think, $100,000 on it. So I was buying a cup. I have to try to mail this and go. I was glad not to go. I don't think it's a mitzvah to spend so much money. Not a wedding, forget that soon. And certainly not an engagement party. I don't see it. You know, the problem is they'll make a tonight, and then they break it. It's considered reprehensible to break the tonight. The grog goes, I can't believe it. It's quoted as saying it's better to have a get, to get married around a get than to break the tonight. I don't believe it, that the grog said it. But still, it's not good. And the original tenoyim was basically a financial penalty. In case you break the engagement, you have to pay cash. This is to defend against the whimsical breaking of the engagement. There are whole responsive literature. What is considered an adequate ground to break the engagement? I just found out something about my kallah, about my cousin, I didn't know before. And I break the engagement because I found out this new discovery. Is that considered legitimate or not? What's the difference? $1 million. Because one side promised, $100,000, whatever. One side promised if they break the engagement, even for both sides promised, if they break the engagement, they'll give $100,000 as a penalty clause to the other party. Because cause of embarrassment. Not a penalty clause of embarrassment. And the Rambam said it's binding. I know of an actual case. Someone I know, a yeshiva in my day, was engaged to a wealthy, the daughter of a wealthy family, and shortly after, a little while after the engagement, she broke it up. He was devastated. On the other hand, the $100,000 check that he received made it the bitter pill go down a little bit more smoothly. That's what the guy was a man of his word, the traditional European dollar bus. His daughter backed out, there was no legitimate reason for it. He gave it the cost of $100,000. That was the amount that was written in tonight. That was an honorable thing to do. It was a great embarrassment, but it's very embarrassing. Today, nothing else is changing about anything. Everybody's breaking everything. They're breaking weddings too. But until then, it was a big embarrassment. Yes? Absolutely, a Kohen named Mary. So I'm not a big fan of these breaking the plates. I'm talking about 2 to 3 months in advance. Then I was going to call a vort. What's a vort? Nothing. Cake and soda. Sometimes they shake hands, they pick up a handkerchief, whatever they do. I don't know. Drink a l'chaim. Oh, that's better. Don't drink anything hard, but it's Pepsi Cola. I don't know, drink a l'chaim. That's good. Torah. Okay. The custom Rav Moshe introduced, Rav Moshe Zatzal, in this book is Shalita, this was in the early 80s, Rav Moshe Zatzal put up a new kind of tzoyim. Doesn't say anything. The old tzoyim said, if I back out, I'll pay $100,000. And all kinds of other agreements. Rav Moshe took it all out, they're going to get married, they're gonna be nice to each other, they're going to use that day. And they won't hide from each other, they're going to split their income, they're split their possessions, which will come to a little later, maybe very significant. Fine. When do you set the date? That's chapter 5. Sure, anything you want.
Is there a new, how do I think
to strengthen the commitment. We believe, Judaism believes a commitment. So you commit yourself to a chassan, to a kallah, you want to formalize it.
Like,
does
it have
to make happen?
No.
I wouldn't even say that. As my pastor, there was tsunami at the wedding.
Right.
And two reasons. One, I think that one of the members of the family wanted it. Two, I created 4 more kibbutzim. I was able to honor 4 more people with the tsunami.
Right. Like,
one arranged it, one read it, two signed it. They're like, you know what that's worth? 4 more people said it before our button.
It's so far in advance, it would be more dangerous.
I happen to agree, but in the old days, people used to get engaged here and then go home to a distant land and sometimes just disappear. If you wanted a certain commitment. I understand. I know the circumstances. Okay. Alright, so your date, your place, both families should agree. If they're from different cities, it's usually held in the city where the bride lives. Cost of the wedding. A wedding is hopefully a once-in-a-lifetime affair. It must be stressed that many of the happiest marriages began with very simple, inexpensive weddings. There's absolutely no correlation between the lavishness of the wedding and the subsequent happiness of the couple. I disagree. I think there is a correlation. If you do the statistics, the more lavish, there's less of a chance of the happiness of the couple. Forgive me for saying so. But I just think, just looking around, there's no correlation. He means that you shouldn't go and think you spend more money to make them happier. I would be a little bit irreverent and say that if there's any correlation, it's in the other direction. Even when money is available, it can be often be better used by the couple to begin a new life together, rather than to make a lavish wedding. Some of the huge debts are incurred, marital problems, lack of money, it's ridiculous. Many times, I'm sorry to give this sentence over here. The bride's parents usually pay for the bulk of the wedding. Alright, now, the question of where this comes from. Not so simple where it comes from. As close as it costs, look at the source in the bottom. Together contribute, depends who's what more money. It's very complicated, these things. It should be done in a spirit of cooperation. Where can it be held? It can be held in the home, in the shul, in the hotel. But don't spend too much. Some catering halls do great, others vulgarize the affair. Blush. You have to watch out. It is sure, right? We discussed that. Okay. Better stop doing some junk. Don't have a minute to have it in the shul. I can't be against it. It's better not, but if there's any reason why it should be done, I think it's good. Yeah. He says, if some hall, the caterer or a band leader acts as the master of ceremonies. That's ridiculous. Most cases they see the bride cuts the cake, the farmer in the dell. It's ridiculous. The rabbi should know what to be done. can of a wedding in the sphere. He goes through these details 3 weeks.
Okay.
What do you have to arrange? First, a rabbi to officiate the wedding. If you're close to a rabbi, he has to officiate. She makes sure the rabbi is a Talmud Chacham. He knows what's going on about Kiddushin. It's called a Masada Kiddushin. The rabbi will ask certain questions. He'll ask, make sure it's a proper wedding. He has they're allowed to marry each other. They'll have a few names. Rabbi Ksuba. Then he puts an invitation. She shouldn't have any Ksukim on, by the way. He doesn't discuss this, I don't believe. The old Shiva should put Ksukim on, because people throw it out. Next, it's been getting a band. You have to have music, but not crazy music. Really, I think it's crazy music. It's a very big problem. You tell your band to lower the volume, by the way. Really, it's a problem. It's deafening, literally deafening. I walked into a gate by the morgue not long ago. I could not hear myself. I could not talk. It was ear splitting. I'm not even so old yet. It was absolutely ear splitting. Okay. Tell the band what to play and more important what not to play. Really? Mission to their business. Tell them. You know, listen to my 20 songs. I'm going to play these 20 songs and that's all. What are you talking? How many songs did the band play in the past? What did you say? More than 30? I don't think so. 30 songs in the back. Photographer should be instructed to be as unobtrusive as possible. Some of them push their way around. It's unbelievable. They want you to marry a second. I've been at weddings. He didn't catch the ring. Can you please give him put the ring on the finger again? He didn't catch it. Do this again? Why? Then it's all to make the bracha again. The ring should be a very simple ring. It should be bought by the husband with his money. It should have no stone. It shouldn't be construed as being worth more than it is. A very plain ring. But they want an heirloom ring. That's a problem. Make sure you know who owns it. And has to be given to the husband. But he should own it. Not so simple. I don't encourage this. Gives you reasons why the ring is used as opposed to other things. Whatever. I'm not going into all these details. You can read it. It's very interesting. Some use gold ring. Silver ring. Different than custom. Mostly use gold. Again, no stone. They shouldn't misrepresent the value. Fine. Next, the talis. This is a traditional gift that the bride gives the groom. Goes back to your early sources. 200 years ago and more. Did the Parshim explain why? From the original source, something called Or Hamor, in the 18th century. Why does a woman buy her husband a talis? Very simple. In the parasha of Tzitzis, it says, we say it every day in Krishna, below Sasur Achrei Levavchem Achrei Nechem. She's telling her chassid in a very subtle way, now you have eyes only for me. She's telling him. Your eyes cannot stray after anybody else. he points out in this phrase, just as the ring symbolizes that she is bound to the exclusion of all of the men, Tala similarly bound to the exclusion of all of the women. He writes, it should be fine. The wedding gown, chapter 8. Very important that beats the that's the most important thing of all when it comes to wedding gown. They'll sell you for the goods. They'll say, well, you know, it has to be low cut, it has to be sheer, it has to be this, it has to be that. That's what people are wearing these days. Bunk. You are the one who orders the wedding gown, not the seamstress, and not the this, and not the that, but the other thing. There was once a wedding when I couldn't make a bra. It was impossible. Very serious problem. Hey, a secret. The best thing to do is not to have your own gown. I'm going to shock you out of your wits. The gown could support the fortune of money, I'm told. I know, it's such a resort to say. My wife never bought herself a gown. No, there are always people who have gowns who are similar size to you when they wear it once in their life. They don't intend to ever wear it again. It's hanging in the closet. You're doing them a favor. They can do a mitzvah with their gown. And you sell them a favor. You don't spend so much money. Unless you have a chiyuv in the Torah to buy yourself your own gown. Really. And if you have a gown, make it available to someone who needs it. Just do an extra mitzvah. Yes. Absolutely white. White. That's an old custom. White. White. Pure. That's what I think. I don't know what ivory means, but white.
Like
off-white. Off-white is off-white. White. White is very good. Okay. He talks about things that I don't really like, I'll tell you the truth. There's an expression called Shoshvinin. A member of the wedding party called the Shoshvin in olden days. It's a term found in Shas. He talks here about the best man and the maid of honor. I don't like this. I think it's a Goyish concept. I don't know what Shoshvin really means in that sense, in my opinion. Usher, bridesmaid, I don't know what he gets this from. I'm against the whole principle. I don't think I'm against the whole thing. So then who marches down with the chasen with the challah? We know that traditionally, in a traditional wedding in Europe, you read about it in the Svara, the chasen was marched down by two people and the challah by two people. It depends which part of Europe you came from. The Hasidic Europe, the chas was marched down by the two fathers and the kala by the two mothers. And in other parts of Europe, the chas was marched down by the father and mother, and the kala by the prior father and mother. That's how that when I got married. It's like I'm Hasidic stock, but we're not that Hasidic. Who else marched down? Members of the family, okay. That to me makes sense. But I'm outside, and I don't see them. They've got whole printed books now. Who's marching down? This one, this friend, that friend. I can't answer it. Okay, it's an absolute prohibition. I don't think it's such a good idea. Yes? Yes. Candles come from Mamad Har Sinai. Chasna is like Mamad Har Sinai. All these examples come from Mamad Har Sinai. That was the chasna of Hashem and Klal Yisrael. The whole idea of this formal wedding with everyone sitting down in an aisle. I mean, I mentioned it to you last time, no? Did I not? No? That does not come from a very Jewish source, I'm sorry to say it. It seems to me that's very likely comes from a different kind of source. In Eretz Yisrael, they have the European, what? Wow, what city? Who, what? My sister got out in Eretz Yisrael. What? Everyone was standing around. And then the chassid came in with his parents, and then the kallah came in with her parents, and then a few old ladies, a few old men, they were too tired to stand, they said that, everyone stood around. That was traditional. as a traditional Jewish marriage. P.S. that marriage also outdoors, which was the old traditional Jewish marriage. Outdoors, under the stars, so that you have the bracha like the stars in the sky. You get married by day, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, they make it happen outdoors in Pahn. What do they do in America? They make a hole in the ceiling. It's America. Class is America. A hole in the ceiling. So, yeah. I would say if you're going to stand up for one, you got to stand up for both. You don't want to be guilty of any kind of chauvinism. In my opinion, there's no need to stand up for anybody. But, what?
Someone just stands up
for them. Look. The truth is better than after the whole ceremony. That's true. But it's a different custom. I can't do, I'm so iconoclastic, I can't rock the boat too much.
But there's
nothing else to do. Yes, there is. Oscar said that the minute is 10 up for a book. Quote, yeah. But I don't want to, you know, I can't, the limit to what I could try to, you know. That's part of the problem. So we should take 10 minutes. It won't take so long. Yes? Well, if they want to have a slip in 10 minutes, they can have a slip. My opinion on this matter is that the particular need to speak under the chuppah, it should be done. If there's no particular need to do it, you know, de rigueur, that should always happen. I don't see a real need for that. Particular need could be, I'll give you an example. I was recently beside the Kedusha, the day before the wedding. So the cousin asked me, maybe I should say a few words. Why? This cousin, his mother passed away some years back, and he remarried. He wanted some mention he made about his mother. He didn't know how to do it. How can you do it? And another woman standing there was a very thing. Maybe he'll speak. He said, Rabbi, maybe he'll speak and he'll somehow. So I gave a drasha, and it's a few minutes, and at the end I said, no, these values were given to the Kala by her parents, and were given to the Chassan by his parents, and I knew them personally, and I know this parent, but that was my illusion. And then I made another illusion to all those things I had in the chuppah together, and that was an illusion to the husband's and his father's new wife, you know, and I had to make, so I went both, doesn't know what the world I was talking about, but those who I don't know, they had to hear it, they heard it. That was an important piece. I've been inside Kedusha with it. It was by Bali Tshuva. And they want to hear a Yiddish word. People don't usually hear a word of inspiration. Someone that the Rav is an excellent inspirational speaker. And I think that's very good. I was recently Rabbi Yudin married off at the door. I think I threw that everyone was either crying or laughing. It was like a spiritual high. That's certainly a compelling reason to give a drush. Usually, when you speak, it's not your own child. I use a wonderful speaker. But I don't know if every single Rosh Hashanah under the chuppah was the same. I can just take away and tell you that you can't. It's impossible. So, parents is capable of speaking with a special significance if they speak well. If they speak poorly, you know, depends on who you're dealing with, you know. So, but to be automatic, I don't think necessarily. Frankly, you know, see, the thing is that sometimes there's a lot of tension under the hook. Sometimes it just extends it, you know, it's just that, you know, it is. But if there's no speech under the hook, to my mind, a good time for a speech would be at the meal. A lot of wasted time at the meal. Wasted time. So if they have a drusha, or even two drushas, even three drushas, as long as they're good, and they talk to the point, I think that's appropriate, again, when it's a customary. At my wedding, there were no drushes, not by the chuppah, not by the meal, nothing. That was the tradition in those days. And there were plenty of good speakers around. But no speakers. That's how it was, and that's certainly an easy way to go. But it can be a very good circumstance. So it's appropriate. There should be a drush. I can't give you a definitive answer when it's this and when it's that. Okay. In many circles, it's a custom for the couple not to see each other during the week before the wedding. The only source you can quote for this It's amazing. It's like you think it's a Tanakh, the Teres HaDibros. He called Sefer Menhagel Lubavitch. Rabbi Chaim Lipschitz, who was the old founder of the Jewish press, in a book written 16 years ago. That's it. There's no other source. Yeah, there is a source in the Hilchos Nida. The Hilchos Nida is taught that when there's anticipation before the chaslas, it can cause a period, it can cause a... That's probably the basis for it. But it's a good custom. It's a good custom, and I think it's a very good idea, but like, you can't even ask what I love. The Shabbos before the Chas, this tradition called the Ofru, calling up. Call up the Chasen. And when they call up the Chasen, they mizamen as a Chasen. That's the expression which is used in the Shulchan Aruch. They sing. In some places they throw bags, called the Barbarim. In our shul, that's the only time we sing for the occasion. I don't like an American, I think it's a bunch of pop service. And with any little simple happens, we graduated from elementary school and someone else, his dog graduated from... everything that's a resentment of a mother's circus, I tell you, it's unbelievable. I think it's crazy. So in my shul, I don't now sing. It was this identical tune, which is sung for Baruch Elokeinu Shebrana Lechvodo V'nasan Lo Torah Semes, which is equally appropriate. That's exactly what the Chassid just said in the Bracha, but V'nasan Lo Torah Semes V'chayal Anu V'sochenu. So we sing that tune. So the other words, which combine the spirit of the Torah by the Nigun of the Jews with the Sameach V'samach, which is the word that we say. We sing the Nigun, we go through the Nigun, we go through it once, twice, if it's traditional.
simple. I said, really, it's a very emotional moment. I mean, it's a very significant moment, you know. The custom and the calendar don't go out by themselves. not the reason. An original reason is the source original. The best thing is to demonstrate that there is not that both be found in the physical. And in marriage, they want to demonstrate, but they're not very nice. Purely the physical modification. Therefore, the test is emphasized the spiritual dimension of it. For the Catholic original story, beautiful.
Today,
cases require that love. So I said, I told love, I said, I have a biblical love. And the real reason is, simple reason, to make sure that a man doesn't take a one hand and turn his wife. Adios. Yes, goodbye. Meaning a deterrent.
Crazy matters
for example.
Think
twice to reach those pocketbook payment silver.
Oh,
we'll take power of the law and see how it should be started on the whim. Try it again. You have to make a financial deterrent. But
simply increase
the as a matter of fact,
there was also a town about the mountain. This will have a flood of the By the way,
it should also give a lot of satisfaction upon
if she has a mother to lose her
husband. Nowadays, most of these Christians now have
beautiful artistic swimmers to be
happy. All right, we'll come.
Consider, liquefies those pulses. No good. Now what do you do? Spent $500 on artwork and I haven't been consistent enough. Yes.
If death
or divorce, if the marriage is terminated, she's still alive. She survived the marriage. By either death or by his death or his divorcing her, if the capital automatically comes upon him or his estate, if he dies, pay her 200
zuz. Say it's
super bad
given or just that
he left it. Says the issue I give to you. Ksuba is a unilateral document that obligates the man to his wife and not vice versa. In it he says he will start with a sum of money, which is imposed upon halachically. He also says, I will support my wife, cherish her, kehilchos guvenu doin, in the manner of the Jewish man, according to the Shulchan Aruch. Very important. All these things are really obligatory, even if he didn't accept it. But our ksubas have two additional obligations, which are not absolutely required. One is called Tosefta Ksuba. I love you so much, I'm going to add to the Ksuba. He adds 100 Zekukim. Now we're talking four-figure sums. Very low four-figure sums, $1,000 on that, but still a four-figure sum. Much more than the Zuzim. Ksuba is some kind of a Polish or German coin. Then there's a thing called a dowry. Oh, the tremendous dowry she brought in for him. So, a dowry means that she's bringing in certain parts to the things to the marriage, some of which she'll get back as such if the marriage terminates, others of which he accepts upon himself a financial obligation to pay back X dollars to her, even if the value of the dowry goes down, or even if it goes up, it's a fixed sum. The gain or the loss is his. That's called Nitzetzon Barza, or part of the dowry. That's also put into the ksuba. Say in the ksuba, if she bought into the marriage, such and such and such and such, you listen to the ksuba, furnishings and beddings and all kinds of things, silver, gold, jewelry, clothing, home furniture, all this stuff, he accepts it upon himself with another 100 silver pieces, another $1,000, whatever it may be. So the ksuba is worth a couple of tenths of the price of silver, $3,000, something like that. And how do you obligate yourself to do this? And pick up a handkerchief. That's the customary, a handkerchief for your pen, if you're anything. Pick up a handkerchief, that's called a suder. Pick it up, and not obligated to speak to whatever's written in the ksuba. The witnesses should see it, and they should sign it. After they see it, figure out, they should sign their names. Some ksubas, they leave out the word bekanina, which is the word indicating that the picked it up. I don't like that, because it causes all kinds of problems later on. I think it's better to write everything in advance, everything, except for the signature, of course. And when you find the bekanina, you should read the ksuba together with the chasim and the two witnesses. Everyone reads it. Now the chasim hopefully knows how to read it, so he knows what it means. Now Moritz can't help him, not to read it, he doesn't know how Aramaic means, to Hebrew. Just try to get witnesses, and we'll still know what the words mean. That's a proper way to fill out the ksuba. Witnesses should know Hebrew and Aramaic well and understand this document before signing it, before showing up. Husband should also know what it says. Ideally. Tell them what it means. And it gives you the text of the Ksuba, chapter 16, goes through every line. The proper date, the proper place. Make sure to do it right. If you make a mistake in the date, it's going to render the whole Ksuba possible. You write the Chassid Kala's name wrong, it's possible. Completely wrong. Now, I hate to break it to you, some of you may be spelling your names wrong. When it comes to Yiddish names, anyone have a Yiddish name? Only one person with a Yiddish name in his whole class? It's hard to believe. I don't believe it. Yeah, well, let me hear you, what's your Yiddish name? Freda. Freda? How do you spell Freda?
Well, how do you really spell it, or how do I spell it?
Well, how should it be spelled? Fei, Reish, Yud. It's wrong twice. Fei, Reish, Yud, Dalet, Aleph. Yeah. That's how it's supposed to be spelled. According to the Halak, Yiddish. I don't know how they spell it to you. In the what's your Yiddish name?
What is Masha?
Masha. How do you spell Masha? How do you spell it? Not right either. It should be Mem Aleph Shin Aleph or Mem Shin Aleph. All Yiddish names have an Aleph at the end. That's the correct way to spell it. And the A sound, according to both poskim, should be spelled with one Yud rather than two. Now I had a problem at my own wedding. I'll tell you personal experience. My wife's name is Fega. She all her life spelled it Fe Yud Yud Gimel Aleph. That's what we've done in the invitation. That's how this. Now, came to the wedding. Rav Soloveitchik, the Kohen was in the Sadeh Kiddushin, and he said, okay, what's the Chala's name? Vega, Fei Yud Gimel Aleph. So my father protested, no, Fei Yud Yud, no, don't tell me how to spell Vega. I said, you want Yud? That's how he spelled it on the Ksuba. And there's some other names that's not clear, is it an A or is it an I? I was recently in the Sadeh Kiddushin when the Caliph name was Vega Trainer, something like that. So we weren't sure if it was one unit, if it was two units, it was a whole complication. I think at the end we spelled Vega with one unit and Trainer with two units. It was even Trainer. I don't remember who we had to look that up. It was very complicated. It's exciting. Why do you spell a name? And after that, spell the name properly. For the most poskim, supposed to spell the name the way it's properly spelled, even though the person spells the name improperly. It happens to the boys too. The most common one is Leib. Then we have a brother or something named Leib, or father or something named Leib. How do you spell Leib? Correct. Lamed Yud Beis. Not Lamed Yud Yud Beis, as many people spell it. There's only one Yud. You can keep spelling it any way you want, but you should know the halakhic way to spell it is the way the post can say. That's what we assume. I guess it's close enough, I'll assume that it's you. But, yeah, you're right. I had a recent shiloh, interesting. A woman in my shul, the Balas Tshuva, when she got married, no one knew what her Hebrew name was. They were English names. So based on the phonetics of her English name, she had two English names they gave her, they approximately gave her two of the Hebrew names to match. A month ago, her grandmother, or her mother, somebody, found a piece of paper. 25 years old, 30 years old, I don't know what she is, 30 years old, saying that she was named with her English maiden name and with a Hebrew name different than the original name. I think the name she was going with was Elisheva Chava, and her name was Leah Chana, or something like that. You know, it was based on the Hebrew. It's a question, what about now? Change her ksuba. The psak was given, since the name was forgotten for 30 years, you know nothing about it, we'll just forget about it for another 100 years. Put it away. Shem Shin Ishtaka was forgotten. We do not put English names into a ksuba. Almost never. I've thought the literature that I would once in a while put in English names into a ksuba. We generally don't put it in. This is what he writes on the capital. If silver is $8 an ounce, then 100 sukkim is $4,000. What is silver now? $3 to the radio fund. What's it? $3 an ounce? What's it down? What is it down? You don't pay attention. The silver fixed, the gold fixed. You don't pay any attention to it, huh? Good. I think it's around $3 or $4. So it's half that. So this is a little less than $2,000. And therefore the whole ksuba is about hakel bakel mikel, about $3,000-$4,000 nowadays. Not much money, is it? Doesn't go too far. Tells you what's mortgageable to the ksuba. The whole story. Okay. It's very important that the ksuba should be filled out properly. We done it early. I try to pull it out not under the lights. Pressure. The lights are on you and it's tumbling, you know, and rubbing and yelling and they're yelling. Hard to concentrate. I try to pull it out. It's privacy of my house. There's no pressure. That's not where I am. Then comes, after the ksuba is filled out, then comes to the baddekin. Traditionally, he has a badekin, means that the chassid puts the veil over the kala's face. And after that, the kala's father gives a bracha, the kala's grandfather, they give a bracha. That's a tradition. The mother can give a bracha also, so it's okay. See them, they cover up with an opaque veil. She can't see anything. The truth is the Ramah's mashma, by the way. The Ramah seems to say she shouldn't be seen, which I would traditionally view, but no, because she shouldn't see. She shouldn't see the ring too well. So in case she sees the ring well, she'll think it's worth more money than it really is. This will be a problem. That's the interesting reason for which the Ramah has. Nowadays, in our circles, they wear a very see-through veil. The chosen, where's the kippel? White, purity, also reminds us of his mortality. Kippel is tachrisha. Marriage is meant to last until the day of death. The chosen say. Not an American concept, you know. Afterwards, it's supposed to be forever. Why not wonder about him when he meets with the chosen? When I'm a sadish, I meet with the chosen count. There were all kinds of different things. But one rabbi I know used to tell the chassid kala to buy karaka. We'll save it to Hillel.
Yeah.
My goodness. I don't know. You know what? I'm a bigger minstrel. Go to sleep. Really, I can tell you chassid kala if they're too tired by the past, it's a disaster. The Bible is a bigger mitzvah than saying take 3 hours to say tefillah. Sleep for 3 hours. I think it's a bigger mitzvah. It sounds so heretical. Sleep 3 hours. You want to sleep 3 hours. Anyway, but to get a nap is very important for many reasons, but I have to run to Geshe-Lay. I have to go a little bit earlier.